Well, good afternoon and welcome to the forum. Today's program, When Loughborough Got It Wrong, presented by our distinguished local historian, Brian Strayer. So I think we're going to have a good presentation and then a chance for discussion afterwards. To begin, Dr. Russell Staples is going to offer a word of prayer.
Let us pray. Dear Father, we bow our heads before thee as we commence this afternoon. Invite thy presence to be with us. Guide us as we think of one of our great early pioneers, one who gave all his life and thought to thy service and thy message. May it renew in our minds also the confidence, the hope, the joy of thy coming, that we might be faithful to thee, and may it help us to bear witness, not merely with what we do, but with all our lives and our full relationships. Guide our director, our brother Strayer, today for the good work he's been done, and lead and bless us, we pray. Amen.
Well, John Norton Loughborough began his ministry in 1849. He was one of the first ordained ministers by the budding denomination that became the Seventh-day Adventists. Despite his early start, he outlived all the other, quote, pioneers of our church and lived to the age of 92 when he died in 1924. As you know, or you will soon know, he had a life with pastoral, missionary, administrative activities, but he also published two book-length historical works dealing with the Adventist movement, and many historical sketches and periodicals. So he's sometimes called the first Adventist historian. But unlike modern, fair, and balanced cable news information sources that we have today, 19th century writers didn't always achieve complete objectivity and freedom from bias. In our presentation today, Dr. Strayer is going to, as a 21st century historian, look back at the possibility of maybe some spin and bias in the historical writings of John Loughborough. So it should be interesting. Our next forum program is 2 weeks from today. Debbie Baris, a local attorney who practices family law, is going to be talking to us about collaborative approaches to resolving conflicts and alternative models for dispute resolution. As usual, we have a sign-up sheet for people who want to get on the email list for notification in the back. And so feel free to add your name if you would like email notices. Thanks to Jim and Debbie and Terry and Daryl and all the people involved in our publicity and electronics and website. We appreciate their efforts. And we appreciate those of you who have contributed financially to help us make these programs possible. Well, as I said, today's discussion is When Loughborough Got It Wrong by Dr. Brian Strayer. He's taught here at Andrews since 1983, earned degrees in history from Southern Adventist University, from Andrews University, from the University of Iowa. And prior to joining the Andrews faculty, he taught at Jackson Junior Academy and Southern Adventist University. His specialty originally was European history, and he's published some what I would consider esoteric or arcane works in that area about subjects that I hardly knew existed, if I did. He has also had a now long-standing interest in Adventist history and actively publishes in that area. His most recent book is the first scholarly biography of J.N. Andrews. J.N. Loughborough. Too many J.N.s here. No, they're all good people. J.N. Loughborough, The Last of the Adventist Pioneers. What you may not know is he's written a couple dramas based on Adventist history. The book which I telling him he may be most remembered with is another recent publication called The Romans Were Known for Their Aqueducts, as in D-U-C-K-S, which is a compilation from a life of grading history papers from undergraduates. And he has retold world history in their words in a little different slant than you've probably ever understood before. So if you want some lighter reading, why, that's a great volume to pick up. I did check the Rate My Professor website to see if I could, you know, find out some interesting background on him. And his latest rating, there are a number of scores that he's rated on. He got 5 for helpfulness, 5 for clarity, but only 2 for easiness. and the immediately preceding entry noted, he got nicknamed Strayer the Slayer for a reason. another comment was, he grades his essays tougher than graduate English courses. So English professors, note that. One last student comment said, great professor, incredibly knowledgeable and enthused about the subject he covers. His expectations are laid out crystal clear on the first 2 days of class. Follow them and get an A. This is college, people. 20 pages of reading every other night and proper grammar aren't huge expectations. So we're grateful. We're grateful for you for sharing with us today, and we'll try to be ready for the quiz.
Thank you, Art, very much. Because this will be a low-tech presentation, I have copies here of the book, Shameless Promotion, without pictures on the screen. The pictures are in the middle of the biography of Loughborough, so I've just asked some friends to give me their copies and just distribute those. If you haven't received a copy or gone to the ABC way, look at the pictures. There's some rather rare photos of the Loughborough clan that have never been published before. And because I don't have the wealth of Oprah Winfrey, I can't put one under each one of your chairs, but they are available at the ABC. Although Jan Loughborough claimed to be descended from English nobility, he was in fact neither lordly nor English, nor in fact a Loughborough. When he was 76 years old, Elder Loughborough asserted in the Pacific Union Recorder that one of his great uncles, a loyalist during the American Revolution, had returned to England and inherited an immense estate from a certain Lord Loughborough. Now, while it is true that Alexander Wedderburn, King George III's chancellor, was ennobled as Lord Loughborough in 1780, both of Wedderburn's marriages were childless. So he bequeathed his estate to his nephew. But throughout his life, Jan Loughborough and his family were more or less obsessed, as one relative put it, with the idea that they were descended from this famous Lord Loughborough. Yet John's ancestry was more than likely Irish, not English. Whereas an inland body of water is called a lake in England and a loch in Scotland, it is described as a lough, L-O-U-G-H, in Celtic. Northern Ireland has Lough Fail, Lough Swilly, and Lough Nia, for example. Borough, of course, means a town or neighborhood. A Loughborough, then, is a lakeside Irish town. But from the Norman conquest in 1066 down to the year 1850, none of J.N. Loughborough's ancestors were actually called Loughboroughs. They were mentioned in the Doomsday Book of 1086 as Luke de Burghs. By the 17th century, they had become Lickbearers and Liffbearers, but the family name gradually morphed into Loughborough in the 19th century, and that's L-O-O-F. John's grandfather was Nathan Loughborough. His father was Nathan B. Loughborough. And from his birth in 1832 down to his marriage in 1851, John's name was also Loughborough. Perhaps it was his first wife, Mary J. Walker, a seamstress from Rochester, New York, of English ancestry, hated the Irish-sounding name and pressured her husband to change it, to anglicize it as Loughborough when they married in 1851, because the first letter that he ever wrote to the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald was signed J.N. Lough, L-O-U-G-H, and that was just a few months after he married. Yet because the entire family, John's mother, his father had died in 1839, and his five siblings likewise changed their surname from Loughborough to Loughborough during the 1850s, probably a better reason for this transformation lay deeply embedded in the American hatred for the Irish. The great potato blight of 1845 and 46 triggered a famine that took the lives of more than a million Irish citizens and propelled another million to immigrate to the New World. Sober, white, Protestant Americans viewed these immigrants as dirty, illiterate, drunken, Catholic roughnecks. During John's boyhood years, the Irish in upstate New York dug the Erie Canal. They built roads and railways, and they fought constantly among themselves. Respectable taverns and hotels across upstate New York posted signs in their windows or on their doors that read, "No dogs or Irishmen allowed." Doubtless, this deep-seated animosity toward the Irish influenced the Loughboroughs to change their name. Elder Loughborough kept this secret his entire life. In fact, he made only one reference to it in his 92 years. He said, "Our name used to be pronounced Loughborough." Yeah, and it used to be spelled that way as well, but he didn't mention that. John also claimed that his grandfather, Nathan Loughborough, had told him stories about fighting with George Washington in the American Revolution. This would have been impossible, since Nathan, born in 1767, was only 8 years old when the Revolutionary War began in 1775. The Daughters of the American Revolution Patriot Index proves, however, that some distant relatives named David, John, and Elias Loughborough served in the American Revolution from New Jersey. The military records show instead that John's grandfather, Nathan, at the age of 27, actually served as a lieutenant in the 3rd Infantry Regiment of Middlesex, New Jersey, during the far less glamorous war called the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794. Perhaps memory lapses or patriotic zeal made John conflate the stories of one family veteran with those of another. From reading his 60 diaries and more than 300 letters available to us, one could assume that Elder Loughborough was never a very good speller either. In truth, John never met a new word he could not misspell, often in several different creative ways. When telegraphs and telegrams were invented in the 1840s, he consistently spelled them T-E-L-L-E-G-R-A-P-H and T-E-L-L-E-G-R-A-M. In 1868, he recorded in his diary that he was leaving by ship with his family by the Isthmus of Panama for the great state of C-A-L-A-F-O-R-N-I-A. 10 years later, he left from the East Coast, headed for the great kingdom of Great Britain, where he frequently indulged his appetite for black licorice and where his family celebrated Christmas for the first time in their lives. For half a century, he butchered the names of his co-workers, Michael P. Chakowsky, George W. Amidon, and A.G. Daniels. He never got that second L in there. Despite Loughborough's poor spelling habits, Ellen White predicted in 1862 that he would be a triumphant conqueror if he faithfully performed the work that God called him to do. In 1890, when General Conference President O.A. Olson wanted to send John to Nebraska as the new conference president, Ellen White opposed this move. "Brother Olson," she wrote, "find someone else for Nebraska and let Loughborough stand in his right place as a Caleb coming to the front. and bearing a decided testimony in the face of unbelief and skepticism. Do not bind him down to any one special conference. What we need now is to cherish Elder Loughborough, to make his experience serve the cause of God in a wider sphere. The Lord would have his voice heard, as was John the Baptist, telling the things which he himself has experienced in the rise and progress of the third angel's message. This letter and her speech in 1913, describing Loughborough as an old soldier of the cross with a message for God's people, inspired him to encourage the people to remember God's leading in the past. Now he understood why the whites had asked him to accompany them in the 1850s, the 1860s, and why he had been privileged to see Ellen in vision so many times. These travels provided priceless opportunities to collect information for his books, the first of which was Rise and Progress, the Great Advent Movement, 1892, and the second one was the great classic, The Second Advent Movement, 1905. Through interviews with the whites, Edson, Bates, Andrews, and others, he learned about the movement before 1852, when he himself had joined it. He filled in the details by perusing issues of the Millerite periodicals, Midnight Cry, Signs of the Times, by reading The Present Truth, the old Advent reviews, and by studying Ellen White's testimonies and her book, Early Writings. But Loughborough never intended to write an objective, analytical history of Seventh-day Adventism. In his preface to Rise and Progress, he states that this book will strengthen the faith of recent converts, will highlight the divine role of Ellen White, will promote the cause of Christ in many hearts, and will show the progress of the work. Its stories would highlight the positive, progressive nature and improvements made within the church. Promotional literature and church periodicals underline these goals. The earliest Review and Herald ad in September of 1892 described the book as composed of Loughborough's personal experiences, information related to the progress of the work, and incidents buttressing Ellen White's ministry against unseen evils. An 1897 ad praised the book for emphasizing the triumphs of the message, describing its prose as soul-cheering and encouraging, quickening the faith of both old and young, and building unfaltering loyalty to the cause of the third angel's message. Loughborough intended to highlight the pioneers' unwavering faith in God and their unfaltering loyalty to the cause. Carefully selected anecdotes would illustrate the providence of God in the building up and preserving of the work through many struggles and difficulties. Loughborough's hectic schedule of preaching, travel, and committee work throughout the Midwest allowed little time for exhaustive research and analytical writing. As his diary shows, and we do have those 60 diaries here in our Center for Adventist Research, as his diary for 1891, 1892 shows, he began his research and his writing at the same time in early 1891. That's not the way we historians do it today. He typically spent about 3 or 4 days with each chapter. In fact, he completed the 29 chapters of Rise and Progress in only 5 months between January and June 1891. But the Review and Herald fire of 1902, the same one that burned the plates for John Harvey Kellogg's notorious book, The Living Temple, also destroyed the plates for Loughborough's Rise and Progress, giving him the opportunity to expand his earlier work. Sponsored by the General Conference and Pacific Press, he wrote the much larger, about 50% larger, Great Second Advent Movement. Once again, his constant traveling to Colorado, California, Missouri, Iowa, and Nebraska in late 1903 and 1904 left him little time for calm, scholarly reflection. He was also suffering from the flu. Nonetheless, he completed the book's 28 chapters in about 5 months with the help of his third wife, Annie Driscoll, who tapped them out on their 1888 vintage typewriter 4 times. He mentions in an article he wrote, "My wife did not do this for recreation's sake." One of the pieces of advice that doctoral students are given to this day: don't ask your spouse to type your dissertation. It puts a great strain on the marriage. As in the case of Rise and Progress, ads for and reviews of the great Second Advent movement praised it for its accuracy, inspiration, and potential to strengthen the faith and confidence of every individual who reads it. Veteran pioneer George I. Butler, who labeled Loughborough the statistician and historian of the whole Advent movement, commended him for including reminiscences, memoranda, and many statistics of passing events of interest in the book. Elder Butler praised the book for its thrilling, wonderful, and soul-inspiring facts, urging Adventists to buy it, read it, and share it with their non-Adventist neighbors. In Butler's opinion, Loughborough had given readers all the facts connected with the early rise of the Great Advent Movement, its struggles, its difficulties, and he had answered all the false reports, the slurs, the innuendos, the falsehoods that had been charged against the Millerites and the early Adventists. Pioneer preacher Stephen Haskell considered the book to be the great monument of Elder Loughborough's long and useful life. It will greatly strengthen and quicken the warmth and piety of those who are in discouragement or depression, or who are cold or backslidden, and will fire their hearts with new zeal, he added. A 1906 blurb in the Review and Herald added that this volume will do much to stem the tide of unbelief in the testimonies which is coming in among us. Beginning in 1907, 2 generations of academy and college students had to pass rigorous exams on Loughborough's book to earn the Missionary Volunteer Award of Achievement Attainment Award in Adventist history. Church leaders believed that reading the Great Second Advent Movement would inspire Adventist youth to live nobler lives. For many years, the editors of the Signs of the Times referred to this book as the most complete account of our church history. Half a century later, church historians L.E. Froom and A.W. Spalding praised Loughborough's book for its unusually interesting stories, contrasting it with the more solid and ponderous compositions of other rather dry writers. Now, those of you who have read either one of these books, Rise and Progress, Great Second Advent Movement, know that Loughborough was indeed a first-rate storyteller. He was Irish, after all. But a careless historian. Convinced that the Millerites were the most humble, God-fearing, conscientious members of the mainstream churches, he portrays them constantly as the best of the early Advent reformers, and the rest of them, especially the Advent Christians, were party-going, bazaar-sponsoring Laodiceans. In doing this, he conveniently glosses over much of the fanaticism within the Millerite ranks, the William Gorgas problem, George Storrs, the main spiritualizers, and so on. Given the short duration of the Millerite movement, 1840 to 1844, both of his books devote an inordinate amount of space to the Millerite movement. 31% of Rise and Progress, 50% of the Great Second Advent Movement. Loughborough has only the highest praise for William Miller, Joshua Himes, Josiah Litch, and Charles Fitch. Neither one of his books contain a single criticism of these leaders. In fact, Loughborough even reached 50 years into the future to cite a statement by Joshua V. Himes in 1895 that he himself had never opposed Mrs. White or her writings to cast a backward favorable light on Joshua Heim's post-Millerite career. However, some statements that Loughborough makes about the Millerites raise questions concerning his research and credibility. His assertion that William Foy sickened and died soon after refusing to share his third vision in 1844, we know to be patently false, thanks primarily to the exhaustive research Delbert Baker invested in this book-length biography. We know that William Foy continued in Christian ministry for another half century. Also questionable, I think, are his assertions that Charles Litch received letters from 1,000 atheists who converted Christianity after his prediction of Turkey's fall on August 11, 1841, and his statistic regarding the active ministry of more than 3,000 Advent preachers worldwide in 1844. Neither Loughborough nor any Millerite leader before him offered any primary sources to back up those statistics. Loughborough was, after all, an evangelist, not a theologian or, strictly speaking, a historian. So he basically preached and presented the doctrines discovered by others. But occasionally, he was mistaken in his prophetic theology. Like such pioneers as James White, R.F. Cottrell, Loughborough speculated, based on Matthew chapter 24, that we have come to the generation which shall not pass off the scene of action until Christ himself shall come. This conviction permeates his books, Last Day Tokens, 1904, Second Great Advent Movement, 1905. He highlights the dark day of May 19, 1780, the Leonid meteor shower of November 13, 1833, and a host of other rather bizarre celestial phenomena in 1843 and 44 as precursors or strange heavenly signs that are directly tied to the 2300-day prophecy, the cleansing of the heavenly sanctuary, the seven last trumpets, the second coming, and the final judgment. And there will be a generation, he predicted, who will see these signs and not die until Christ returns. But as we all know, being Monday morning quarterbacks, all of those signs passed and all of the pioneers died. Likewise, Loughborough erred in asserting that only Advent Christians and not the Sabbath-keeping Millerite Adventists had believed that the shut door, a reference to the parable of Matthew 25, meant no more mercy for sinners after October 22, 1844. As a matter of fact, in an August 24, 1874 letter to Elder Loughborough, Ellen White told him that in 1844, she and her siblings, her brother Robert, her sisters, did believe that no more sinners would be converted. But she added that she had never had a vision supporting this view. Then in a fascinating exchange of letters, we have those letters in the Center for Adventist Research, 1917, 1918, letters back and forth between E.S. Ballinger, who was the brother of Albion Fox Ballinger, accused Elder Loughborough of making false statements and misusing quotations to deceive his readers regarding the true facts relating to the shut door views of the pioneers. Citing primary sources, Ballinger demonstrates that the Whites, Bates, E.P. Butler, and others held on to their shut door views as late as 1851, long after the Advent Christians had abandoned their shut door views in 1845. Calling Loughborough's coverage of this doctrine in the Great Second Advent Movement absolutely false and deceitful, Elder Ballinger urged him to repent and confess before his enemies exposed his fraud. Loughborough, who by that time was 87 years old, replied to Ballinger's accusations by labeling him one of six people that are going after the old man in his declining days. Using satire, Loughborough debunked Ballinger's claim that the phrase shut door always means no more mercy for sinners. He defended himself by asserting that he had only reported what he had heard the pioneers say with their own mouths. Therefore, he said, I have a clear conscience, void of offense toward God and man. Playing for sympathy, he added, this is none of my funeral, and I am not yet convinced that I am liable to lose eternal life over this case. Ballinger, convinced otherwise, sent the aged pioneer a handwritten confession to sign. We have that confession, the Center for Advanced Research. Loughborough demurred, saying that he would wait until his enemies make their confession, and then I can endorse it. Despite the fact that the Ballingers were considered heretics in their day, Adventist historians today agree that the weight of primary evidence amply supports E.S. Ballinger's argument about the shut door and how long it lingered within Sabbath-keeping Adventist ranks. Loughborough also defended the Millerite view of the daily, which is a phrase referred to in Daniel 8, verse 13. He saw the daily as paganism and thus allied himself with the views of William Miller, Apollos Hale, Uriah Smith, and Stephen Haskell over against the views of R.L. Crozier, W.W. Prescott, and G.C. President A.G. Daniels, who felt that the daily referred to Christ's ministry in the heavenly sanctuary. Loughborough and Haskell, convinced that Ellen White had once held their view, tried in 1907, 1908 to persuade Elder Prescott to publish their articles on the daily in the Review. But the editor refused, gently explaining to them that we are being attacked from all sides now. I desire to use all care not to give anyone grounds upon which to successfully make warfare on our teachings. This standoff led to an infamous meeting at Elmshaven, Ellen White's home in California, January of 1908. It was attended by the GC president, A.G. Daniels, by the Haskells, husband and wife, Loughborough, Prescott, W.C. White, C.C. Chrysler, D.E. Robinson, and Ellen White herself. And at that meeting, Elder Prescott pressed his views on Elder Daniels for 4 solid hours. When Prescott still refused to publish articles on the daily in the Review, Elder Haskell agreed to publish them in his magazine, The Bible Training School. Now, despite being twice rebuked by Ellen White, 1908, 1910, for his stubbornness in pushing the daily, Elder Loughborough clung to his views to the end of his life. Until World War I and beyond, this esoteric topic fueled a tempest in a teapot for an entire generation of our pioneers. But who really were those pioneers? G.I. Butler asserted that only those who had participated in the Millerite movement and who had laid the foundations of this glorious work qualified as real pioneers. Now, his list included Joseph Bates, James Nolan White, J.N. Andrews, Uriah Smith, J.H. Wagner, and, of course, Loughborough, but not Elder Haskell and not himself, because they had converted in the 1850s. Interestingly enough, in 1921, Elder Loughborough himself drew up a list of 21 original pioneers who had joined the movement in 1844. He put his name on the list. Technically, however, Loughborough did not qualify as an original pioneer. He was only 12 years old in 1844. He did not begin preaching until he was 17 in 1849, and he did not become a Sabbath-keeping Adventist until 1852. And yet, as Art mentioned in the introduction, longevity has its advantages. By the time he died in 1924, at the age of 92, he had outlived all the original pioneers and most of the second crop as well. Between 1915 and 1924, Adventist admiration for Elder Loughborough approached veneration. Even during his lifetime, they granted him titles given to no other pioneer: Venerable Counselor, Venerable Elder, the oldest living pioneer of the Third Angel's Message, the oldest minister in our ranks, our revered brother, and dear father in Christ. But soon, his fame began to outstrip the facts. In the Workers' Bulletin for 1915, A.R. Ogden falsely asserted that Elder Loughborough had been one of the very first to accept the message in the 1840s. Loughborough was not converted to Sabbatarian Adventism, however, in 1852. In 1924, E.K. Slade stated that never has he been called to follow any sort of side issue. What about that tempest in a teapot called the Daily? Announcing his death in April of 1924, S.J. Lashier, the editor of the North Pacific Union Gleaner, even added a year to Loughborough's life, telling readers that Elder Loughborough had just died at 93. He was 92 in 2 months. The Pacific Union recorder claimed that he had been the first ordained minister in our ranks in 1854. Actually, Washington Morse had been ordained in 1851. In his books and articles, Loughborough's treatment of his Seventh-day Adventist contemporaries is uniformly positive, even adulatory. He portrays them as earnest, praying, sacrificing individuals who labored incessantly and whose faith was abundantly blessed by God. Rise and Progress and Great Second Advent Movement contain not a single critical comment concerning Joseph Bates, James Nelson White, J.N. Andrews, Uriah Smith, Hiram Edson, Stephen Haskell, Hetty Haskell, G.I. Butler, or even John Harvey Kellogg. By the way, J.N. Loughborough was the only Adventist pioneer I know of who was invited to eat in the Kellogg home. Why? Because he was a strict vegetarian. And most of our ministers were not. Kellogg only invited vegetarians into his home. For Loughborough, those who gave their all and whose lives ended well deserved to have their faults overlooked. But what of those unconsecrated persons, as he phrased it, whose actions brought perplexities into our ranks? Nearly always, he stated, the root of their problem lay with their opposition to Ellen White's prophetic gift, after they had been reproved for defects in their characters, for wrong habits, or for some wrong course in their manner of life. Those who refused to repent, he said, either lost their spirituality, formed apostate groups that ultimately failed, or left the truth and died quickly. Those who opposed the testimonies, he said, were constructing cobweb houses to fight the visions, and they could not succeed. Yet, as his diaries and letters attest, during the last 4 years of his life, Elder Loughborough labored hard to combat certain false teachings being put forth by Adventist apostates Dudley M. Canright, A.F. Ballinger, Anna Phillips, and Margaret Rowan. But even some of Loughborough's teachings and practices would not pass for truth today. Based on a vision given Ellen White in 1846, Elder Loughborough believed that Jupiter and Saturn were inhabited by tall, majestic people who had never sinned. But since those planets, as Art showed me this morning, have neither air nor water to sustain life, this seems unlikely. He also expounded on the notion of vitalism in the New Pacific Health Journal, writing enthusiastically about vitality, vital operations, the vital power given to each person at birth. Disease, intemperance, and sexual intercourse overtax our energies, waste our life force, and shorten our days, he warned. Modern medical science does not support this popular Victorian concept of vital force. Finally, although he claimed to be a health reformer, he read Caleb Jackson's Water Cure Journal, he helped establish the Western Health Reform Institute. Elder Loughborough's diary shows that while he ate healthfully and exercised regularly, during most of his life he took only one bath a month. Only after he retired in 1897 did he form the habit of taking a daily cold bath. That may have extended his life. You can do that more easily in California, too, by the way. If Luckrow frequently misspelled words, he occasionally muffed his dates as well. And I'll just give you a handful. Voltaire, who died in 1778 in France, could not have predicted the demise of the Bible during the French Revolution of 1789. The Reign of Terror lasted from 1792 to 93, not from 1793 to 95. The Advent Christians were not the only ones setting new dates for the Second Coming after 1844. Many Sabbath-keeping Adventists continued to do so well into the 1850s. William Miller died in December of 1849, not in 1848. Joseph Bates' first trip to Jackson, Michigan, occurred in July of 1849, not 1851, when he made his first trip to Battle Creek. Luckrow mistakenly asserted that Ellen White had her first health reform vision in a tent on June 3, 1863. She herself says that vision occurred in the home of Aaron Hilliard on June 6. More serious than occasional inaccurate dates, however, are what I would call the subtle spins and the holy hyperbole that permeate his writing style. Although only 2,400 people lived in the township of Victor, New York in the 1840s, which is where Luckrow was born, he claimed that over 500 citizens converted to Millerism in 1844. That would be fully 20% of the total population. Even if that figure were accurate, which I doubt, other sources indicate that most of those who converted to Millerism in Victor, including John's own grandparents, returned to the Methodist Church by 1845. His claim that the Advent Christians used mesmerism, hypnotism, to gain adherence is not supported by other extant sources. In addition, his allegation that spiritualism in 1848 threatened the moral overthrow of the American people seems rather exaggerated, as do his statistics for Sabbath keepers. In 1854, he says there were 1,000 Sabbath-keeping Adventists. 1856, he says 2,000. That seems very high to modern Adventist historians. One also wonders how many international health journals Luckrow had actually examined when in 1905 he declared that Good Health, which was the name of the Adventist health journal, is now the leading health magazine of the world. By contrast, his assertion that the tithing plan, which came in 1878, was essentially the same as the earlier systematic benevolence plan of 1859, understates the key difference between the two. Systematic benevolence only required 10% of one's increase from one year to the next. Tithing took 10% of one's entire income each year. So an example would be a farmer who makes $500 one year and $550 the next. He would pay $5 systematic benevolence, 10% of the $50 increase, whereas he would return $55 tithe, 10% of the $550. There were two quite different systems here. Luckrow's omissions are just as significant as his exaggerations. It is astonishing that in Rise and Progress, 1892, Great Second Advent Movement, 1905, Luckrow says nothing at all about the righteousness by faith controversy. He does not even mention the 1888 Minneapolis General Conference session, which he did not attend, although he was the president of the California Conference at the time. Why? Perhaps, and this is just speculation on my part, perhaps the fact that he had very close friends and co-laborers on both sides of the theological debate, that is A.T. Jones, E.J. Wagner, Ellen White on the one side, and Uriah Smith and G.I. Butler on the other, influenced our pioneer historian to take a don't ask, don't tell stance. So far, I have found nothing in his letters or diaries or published articles to explain this glaring omission. He's the only Adventist historian to ignore 1888. When General Conference President G.I. Butler retired immediately after the Minneapolis Conference, Luckrow gave as the reason that Butler's failing health caused him to retire. There was not a word about the fact that Butler's doctrinal conflicts with Jones, Wagner, and Ellen White forced him into retirement. Loughborough's lifelong support of Ellen White took shape during 7 days in the fall of 1852, when as a 20-year-old Adventist preacher, he attended J.N. Andrews' meetings in Rochester, New York. At the last minute, Elder Andrews changed his sermon, and unbeknownst to Andrews, used every single text that Loughborough had written down and had in his pocket against the Ten Commandments and the Sabbath to prove the perpetuity of both the Sabbath and the law. Then the Whites invited John to witness the miraculous healing of pressman Oswald Stoll, who was dying of pleurisy. And following anointing and prayer, he was immediately healed. Following a vision, Ellen White revealed Elder Loughborough's private thoughts that he had not shared with anyone, including his wife, Mary. She also rebuked a secret adulterer who lived in Rochester but had committed an act of adultery in Pawpaw, Michigan, 600 miles away. Finally, John's wife Mary saw the deliverance of a Mrs. Riggs from demon possession on the spot. Convicted, John and Mary accepted Sabbatarian Adventism and ever after had the utmost confidence in Mrs. White, seeing her testimonies as light direct from heaven. More than any other pioneer, it is Elder Loughborough who emphasized in his writings the physical phenomena attending Ellen White's visions. It is from him that we receive the stories of her superhuman strength, having no breath, having no pulse, her eyes staring off into space, and so on. It is from him that we get the memorable stories about her holding out the 18-pound Bible, walking beside a vicious colt, well envisioned, and revealing the secret sins of dissidents. Throughout his life, Elder Loughborough claimed to have seen Ellen White in vision about 50 times as they traveled together in the Midwest between 1852 and 68. Later in life, he revised this figure down to more than 40 times. At the end of his life, he revised it still further down to about 40 times. Given the fact that Loughborough was a notorious compiler of lists and facts, it is somewhat problematic that he nowhere provides documentation for all of these visionary experiences, not in his letters, not in his diaries, nor in his published books or articles. A search in the Ellen White bibliographic file here at the Center for Adventist Research found only 36 visions mentioned between 1852 and 1868. Cross-checking these 36 bibliographic file entries with accounts of Ellen's visions given in Rise and Progress and Great Second Advent Movement indicates that Loughborough could have observed Ellen White in vision at least 17 times between 1852 and 1874. And yet he describes only 7 of those visions in detail from firsthand observation. The others he seems to have learned about from others, letters from Mrs. White or conversations with those who were there. Moreover, the White estate's long-held claim that Ellen White had about 2,000 visions and dreams is based on estimates compiled by Arthur White in the 1970s. In fact, the 3-volume comprehensive index of the writings of Ellen White, volume R through Z, lists only 348 visions from 1844 to 1915, about 5 a year. Many of these may be overlapping, as several entries bear the exact same date, which suggests that some visions covered multiple issues. According to this list, Mrs. White had about 90 visions between 1852 and 1868, so it is theoretically possible that Loughborough could have observed her in half of them, although we lack concrete proof for this. Several times, Ellen White sent Elder Loughborough personal testimonies of rebuke based on her visions. In every case, he humbly accepted her scolding. In 1861, she admonished him for his hesitancy to preach Adventist truths boldly in Parkville, Michigan. He responded, "I deeply mourn that I have ever been left to thus cripple my testimony, and bring leanness into my own soul. I trust I shall have strength from God in future to bear the straight testimony required by the third angel's message. In 1867, she reprimanded him and other ministers for making money on the side by selling photographs. He replied, "I would say that I deeply regret that in this matter I too have been at fault. Brethren, forgive me. I will try to walk more circumspectly in the future." 2 months later, she scolded him again for making critical remarks about her husband, James. John immediately sent them a letter confessing, "I deeply regret what I have said or done or written that has wounded the feelings of yourself or Sister White. I am sorry that I have not always maintained that demeanor toward you that I felt when you were first taken sick," he's referring to the stroke back in 1865. "I find in searching my own heart that the talking over your course with a few here while you were sick, although not designed to defame or injure you, has in some measure blunted those tender feelings I had toward you. In view of your enfeebled condition while sick, I do not think I made that allowance I should for your infirmities. I wish to say I have wronged you in this respect. I fear, as Sister White said to me, that I have been led of the devil instead of the Lord. I need to be humbling myself instead of trying to lead others. Forgive me wherein I have wronged you. May the Lord enlighten my mind to see clearly all my wrongs." In fact, before the Loughborough's left California to go to England in 1878, John stood up before the California constituency at a camp meeting at Yountville, and he read a lengthy apology. He apologized for his past mistakes and his harsh words. And then he added, "I should have made more mistakes than I have had it not been for the counsel and instruction I received from the first by the gift of prophecy as manifested through Sister White." Loughborough told C.E. Holmes in 1920 that he had saved every single Ellen White testimony with direct instruction from the Lord for me, specifically those that she had written out in 1862, 1878, 1886, 1890. Obviously, the two pioneers shared a relationship of complete confidence. When suffering from dropsy in the 1850s, Ellen summoned John Loughborough to pray for her healing. In doctrinal matters, she trusted him implicitly in the 1870s. This relationship doubtless influenced Loughborough, especially in his 1892 book, Rise and Progress, to portray Ellen White as playing a much larger role in the early development of our church than the sources would warrant. Years later, her son, W.C. White, told John that Ellen White herself felt that Loughborough had given her a more prominent role in the founding of the early church than she felt she deserved. Perhaps this explains why, when Loughborough was writing his much greatly expanded Great Second Advent Movement in 1904, he took great care to send copies of the manuscript to Mrs. White and ask her to critique it prior to publication in 1905. After his retirement from active ministry in 1907, especially following Ellen White's death in 1915, Loughborough continued to revere her writings. In fact, this is material that I gleaned from his own personal diaries. Between 1903 and 1922, he drew up his own detailed typewritten indexes to all 9 volumes of her testimonies, Great Controversy, the 4-volume Spirit of Prophecy set, Acts of the Apostles, Christ's Object Lessons, Steps to Christ, and every one of her front page Review and Herald articles from 1880 onward. In 1911-1912, he read over 16,000 pages of her writings to compile a comprehensive list of more than 100 fulfilled prophecies. Despite his many errors, however, John Norton Loughborough left behind a staggering legacy that shapes our church today. His hundreds of articles in church periodicals helped make the prophetic expositions of Daniel and Revelation by Jan Andrews and Rye Smith the standard view of our church. Through lengthy letters and visits with Arthur W. Spalding, F.M. Wilcox, L.E. Froom, near the end of his life, Loughborough passed the torch of writing apologetic history to the next generation. In return, the Advent cause he supported for 72 years has honored him in multiple ways. In 1897, J.E. Fulton named his new mission boat for mission work throughout the Pacific, the Loughborough. After 1906, Adventists began eating communion bread, as we did this morning at PMC, made to a recipe Loughborough adapted from the Jewish Passover bread. In 1907, his book, The Church, Its Organization, Order, and Discipline, became the first unofficial denominational manual. In fact, when the first official denominational church manual came out in 1931, there were some Adventist pastors that refused to use it. They liked Loughborough better. Well, most Adventists in the 1970s probably thought Elder Glenn Kuhn actually counted the 3,573 Bible promises he urged believers to claim in his book, ABCs of Bible Prayer. In fact, Elder Kuhn stole that statistic from Loughborough, who actually tallied them up in 1916 after reading his Bible through 76 times. His example inspired the Loughborough League of Devotional Reading, begun by the General Conference in 1954. Although few read Loughborough's works today, and I have some of them spread out here on the front table if you'd like to look at them later, his legacy endures. A quarter mile stretch of road by the Merced, California, Seventh-day Adventist Church was named Loughborough Street in 1968. In 1971, the members there named their multi-purpose gymnasium auditorium, the Loughborough Memorial Auditorium. A year later, they dedicated a new church school and called it the Loughborough School. Now, America already has Dollywood and Disneyland. Perhaps in Merced, California, we shall someday see Loughborough Land. In the 1980s, the British Union purchased a Roman Catholic secondary school in London and renamed it Loughborough School. Its 340 black students adopted maroon and white uniforms, Loughborough's favorite colors. And they so outperformed other British students in math and English that the House of Lords began studying the John Loughborough students as a model for other inner city schools. No doubt the Irish commoner John Norton Loughborough would be delighted. Thank you very much.
Okay, questions?
From all the exaggerations and omissions, it almost seems like he can't be trusted with his information, almost. Should we?
Now, this is coming from one of my Adventist Heritage students. They're all sitting there in the back row. I thought probably someone would ask me that question. All right, Tim. Here's the way I look at it. I don't believe that Elder Loughborough ever intended to lie. A lie is an attempt to deceive. I think what Elder Loughborough was doing was putting a spin on the facts to promote a positive image of our church and its history. You could say that the glass is half full of water, or you could say the glass is half empty. Either way, it can go either way. He was Irish. Irish like to tell good stories. He was a narrative historian. He liked to have a story that built faith and courage and helped our Adventist believers have confidence in Ellen White and in their history. E.S. Ballinger, of course, had a different view. By omitting certain facts, he said, Elder Loughborough, you are deceiving, whether you intend to or not. It's an interesting exchange of letters, really. And Loughborough wrote back, my conscience is clear. So I think from his perspective, he was doing his God-ordained work to promote a view of Adventist history that would inspire confidence and faith. I think in part as well, Loughborough joined the movement in 1852. Between 1844 and 1852, a lot of this debate and argument and doctrinal change had taken place, and he wasn't in on that. So what he said about the shut door was accurate enough by the time he came along, 1852, but he wasn't there, 1844 to 1851. So I think, you know, we can take him at his word that, you know, his conscience was clear. He was simply trying to write books that promoted a view of Adventist history that inspired faith. As a 21st century historian, we would say, okay, but those are more mission books, mission story books. They're more devotional style books. They're not the type of objective, scholarly, footnoted, bibliograph books that we would write today. They're not the type of books that we would feel today promote an accurate interpretation of Adventist history. In the main, you know, having read hundreds and hundreds of pages, thousands, I would say, thousands of pages of his articles, pamphlets, and books, he got most of the facts right. He got most of the facts right. But it's the interpretations that we might disagree with. I'm fond of saying, I know my colleagues and my students have heard me say this, you are entitled to your own interpretation. You are not entitled to your own facts. And one of the facts that my book has raised some hackles about that I never expected, the one that's going around here, has to do with Elder Loughborough's ordaining a female elder on New Year's Day, 1899. And the fact of the matter was that her name was Leta Silkwood, all right? L-E-T-A, Leta Silkwood. And he ordained her at a Sabbath service out there in California. This is the first incident we know of, the first case where someone, a pioneer, ordained a woman as an elder. There were some women in Australia, New Zealand, being ordained as deacons or deaconesses. I'm not sure the word deaconess had come in yet, female deacons, but this is the first one. And I've been hearing from all sorts of people on campus and off campus, well, Leta Silkwood had to have been a man then. Those who say that are entitled to their own interpretation, but the fact of the matter is, Leta is an old Greek word. Those of you acquainted with Greek history, like Dr. Our theologian here, Bob, know that Leta was the mother of Helen of Troy, whose beautiful face launched 1,000 ships that brought about the so-called Trojan Wars in ancient Greece, between Troy, the Eastern Mediterranean, and the Greek city-states. Now, if Leta was the mother of Helen in ancient Greece, I don't see how she could change her sex by the 19th century and become a male. But that is going the rounds right now as we head down to the ordination of women issue at the General Conference. It just baffles my mind. You're entitled to put your own spin on it, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And that I got from the diary of Dan Loughborough himself. So there's just a concrete example, Tim. It continues to this day. All right.
About Loughborough's sources.
Yes.
Was he largely relying on kind of folk memory, or on the reminiscences of his colleagues? Was he making things up, just filling in empty blanks? Where do you think he got some of these ideas?
Okay. Once again, his diaries are quite clear because he gives a day by day, week by week, month by month account of his writing progress and his research progress. He actually did interview a number of the early pioneers who went through the 1844 experience. He had a year or two up in New England in 1860, 61. He took time out to interview those that were still living. He read, according to his own account, I don't see how he did it in 5 months, but he read some of the Millwright magazines, newspapers. He read the issues of the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald. By the time of his death, he could actually claim that he had read every issue of the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald from 1850 to 1924, every issue. And he read Ellen White's books, like Experience and Views. As many papers and pamphlets as he could get a hold of, he read. So according to his diary, he did his digging. But the thing that baffles me, he was also writing while he was researching. And how you can write a chapter in 1 to 3 days baffles. Maybe George Knight can do that. You know, he's an exception to the rule, I suppose. But Loughborough is researching and writing at the same time, and that doesn't give adequate time for, you know, thought, reflection, analysis that we historians today like to do. But he did do his digging, according to his diary.
Brian, we talked about it before, but let me be clear. In his diaries, did he say that he ordained Lita, or did he specifically say the lady or the woman named Lita?
No, he didn't mention lady or woman. But you and I looked it up, didn't we? Online. The mother of Helen of Troy.
Thank you. Very interesting.
You're welcome.
Regarding his influence in North America particularly, I'm thinking. My father studied at Avondale, graduated there with Roy Allen Anderson. And they used Loughborough a great deal there. He would talk about it. And in South Africa, later, when I was at Helderberg, this is about 1941, 42, this was almost the standard Bible text, the great Second Advent movement. And Loughborough was shaping the church. And so I gather the influence of Loughborough in Australia and South Africa was very high. Anything, was it more, was it larger there than in North America, perchance?
Well, yeah, to gauge by what I've read in the Union papers, if Elder Loughborough could be at your camp meeting that summer, you had a major, major event and a big draw. If Loughborough could not be at your camp meeting, you just expected you were going to have smaller attendance. So, you know, he was sort of almost an icon, a hero. I mean, he had outlived nearly every other pioneer. The very fact that he could still go, and he was still preaching. He was still preaching at 90. He wasn't traveling quite as far, but he was still preaching. People just love to hear him talk. And you listen to those as well who, after his death, testified that they were little children at these meetings, and how he would call all the little children up to the front row and tell them stories, and how they still remember that. He was a huge draw in North America. It would be equivalent, you know, to an HMS Richards coming to your camp meeting, I suppose. Outstanding person.
It seems to me that at a time like this, it would be very important to lay to rest the charge about the gender of Lita Silkwood. And it seems to me that just studying out the origin of the name is not sufficient scholarship to prove that she was feminine, because there are many parents that give their kids very strange names, mm-hmm. even though it might be most likely. But wouldn't it be an easy thing to check the census records or the obituary files or something concrete that would tell us what gender she was?
That's a very good idea. One of the staff members in the Center for Advanced Research actually tried to get a hold of the Santa Ana, California church records, you know, which would be an excellent thing to get a hold of. But, you know, 1899 is so far back, church records get destroyed. He wasn't able to get a hold of those.
Have
so,
the obituary files at the review?
That would be probably, Madeline, this is something I just mentioned in passing in my book. I had no idea it was going to be a tempest. We might as well go back and talk about the daily here. It's just causing such a ruckus. What I have done, and I shared this as well with the Dosses. This just really baffled me, and so I went and sat at my computer for a couple hours and drew up every male and female 19th century name that I could think of. And every female name, would end in A. There are no male names ending in A. I've got the list here. I mean, you can create a female name by adding the letter A. And I'll just read a few of them to you here. You've got Brian for male and Brianna for female. You've got Edwin and Edwina. You've got Frederick and Frederica, Henry and Henrietta, Jules and Julia.
I'm not questioning that, I'm just saying for some of these other people, that would not be sufficient probably, right. And say, well, you don't know.
Yeah.
But I think if you had a concrete document, like a census file or an obituary file.
You're not, but can I jump in? Here's one small thing I just looked up on the Social Security Administration records, and they only show the top 1,000 names for each year back to 1900, as far as I can find. But Lita, as a woman's name, was number 348 of female names used in 1900, and it stayed in the top 1,000 until 1960. Now, obviously, if she was ordained in 1899, she was born well before that. But and Lita, as a man's name, was never in the top 1,000 any time back to 1900. So that, at least, is a small thing. But I think it would be good to look up the census records. They should be available for 1900 or 1899 for her, and I haven't looked that up yet.
Okay. Thank you.
It's been a long time since Roy Graham was here, but when he wrote his dissertation, he mentioned Loughborough along with Haskell and a third person, Paulson, as being three individuals that helped portray Ellen White in a more transcendent way than a lot of people thought of her generally in the church at the time. You haven't mentioned Paulson's name. Is his name significant?
No, I stuck, pretty much with the contemporaries here of Loughborough. Paulson would be after that.
After that?
Yeah, after that. Because Loughborough died in 1924.
I'm not talking about any of the Paulsons we've had here. This is an ancient pioneer. But you don't know that.
I don't.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? All right, let's thank Professor Rayer or Slayer. I don't know.
Slayer, right.